Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle. Because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Do you want to make a podcast? Spotify's got a platform that lets you make one super easily. It's called Spotify for Podcasters. It lets you record and edit podcasts right from your phone or computer. So no matter what your setup is like, you can start creating today. Then you can distribute your podcast to Spotify and everywhere else podcasts are heard. Video podcasts are also available on Spotify. You know I love that. And I promise you, the other platforms don't offer that. With Spotify for Podcasters, you can also earn money in a variety of ways, including ads and podcast subscriptions. And best of all, it's totally free with no catch. I've been using Spotify for Podcasters from the very start. I highly recommend you give it a try. Just don't post on Monday. Download the Spotify for Podcasters app or go to www.spotify.com/podcasters to get started. Welcome everyone to Monday Match Analysis. I'm Gil Gross. Today's episode is the 2024 Australian Open first round mailbag. This is a tradition that we do on the channel. The first Monday of every major is when it usually occurs. But I thought for this unique Australian Open schedule, it might be nice to just let the first round end and then do the mailbag. So that's what we've done. All first round matches are over. And I asked you for your questions, your hot takes, your observations, and ultimately your comments about tennis or anything else. Yes, I know it's a little bit confusing. It's when the two podcasts that I do every week collide into one. Let's get into it. First one is from Adrian. Top liked comment here. Hey Gil, do you have any words of consolation or hope for us Denis Shapovalov fans? Or should we switch to a new player to support so we can find some joy in our lives? Shapovalov makes his comeback. And he loses in straight sets to Jakub Mensik, who is talented, young player who I'm still kind of gathering information about. I want to watch a little bit more. I did watch him in person against Taylor Fritz on his birthday at the U.S. Open last year. But I'm not really ready to like evaluate his game right now. But one thing that stands out immediately, big, strong kid with plenty of power. So that is Shapo's comeback match, and I guess that's the impetus for this question. For now, the answer is give him a sec here. Give him some time to get his feet back under him. You know, I mean, we saw like last year, think about the start that Zverev had in January. He lost a match at the Australian Open to Michael Moe. And then by the end of the year, he was a top 10 player. So definitely give Shapovalov a moment here. And by the way, it was his first match since Wimbledon. That's not true. He played in Auckland and he lost to Sebastian Offner in straight sets. So 0-2 starts 2024 for Shapovalov. Yeah, give him some time. I will say more broadly, this is an interesting question when it comes to Shapovalov. Because I guess it has been a little bit tough since the Wimbledon 2021 semifinal. And personally, I think when it comes to your expectation for Denis as a fan, you should maybe do what I do as an analyst, which is figure out what his expectation is for himself. The reason I say this is because Denis Shapovalov said something after the 2021 season that really stuck with me in a big way and changed the way I thought about his career. And I was ready, you know, for him to change my mind since that point. But let me first tell you what he said. He said that after the Wimbledon 2021 semifinal, he struggled to find motivation for the rest of the year. That's what he said. And man, his results weren't good for the rest of the year. So those things certainly aligned. And I thought to myself, if you are so satisfied by making a major semifinal that you can't light the fire in your belly for the rest of the season, then what are you actually expecting out of yourself? How good do you think you should be, Denis Shapovalov? Like, that was my reaction to that. Because for me, he's got the talent to be a bona fide top 10 player who makes the semifinals of majors all the time. How is it that satisfying to you that you feel like you're done for the year, that you struggle to motivate yourself? Now, I'm sympathetic to this dynamic when a player achieves something really, really big, they struggle to motivate. I get that. But it makes a lot more sense when you're Dominic Thiem, for example, and you're 27 years old and you win your first major, which you've been working for your entire career. Young player with loads of talent makes a semifinal and that does it. So that is the first time I started to have questions about his mentality. And my thing is, if Shapo doesn't want it really bad to be elite, right? If he doesn't want to be elite really, really bad, I'm not going to hold him to that standard. I'm not going to be, you know, I'm not going to come here and, you know, constantly harp on what Shapo needs to do better and how Shapo should be doing better if he doesn't want that for himself. So as a fan, I feel like you should maybe be making that same measurement of what does Denis want? And that should maybe be how I look at it, right? Like if you're a Bublik fan or something like that, like you're probably not super frustrated every time he loses because like you know that that's not really what Bublik is about. Bublik is about a lot of other stuff that I like and appreciate. Super lovable guy, really talented on the court, fun to watch play. So if you're a Bublik fan, you're probably not like, come on, man, like, what are you doing here when he loses? You probably have an understanding that that's part of the Bublik experience. So I would say if you're a Shapovalov fan, you should start to like figure out those kinds of calculations of like, what is the bar? What is the expectation for Shapo? Next one is from Malakat. Okay. Hey, Gil, have you watched the Felix versus Thiem match that occurred? If so, what are your thoughts on the match? And do you believe that this win will reignite Felix's confidence in himself? Hope you enjoy the rest of the AO month and all the best to you. Thank you. This match was commented on by a lot of people, so I just took this comment, which was very generic, and this will serve as kind of the Felix versus Thiem analysis portion of the show. It was a five-setter. If you missed it, Felix won, I think it was 6-3 in the fifth, if my memory serves, but I'm almost positive it was one break of serve in the fifth set. Might have been 6-4. All right, tactically, here was the trend. Thiem did well in the rallies. Rallies, five shots or more. Thiem won over the course of the match 63 to 48. So that's plus 15 for Thiem in the extended exchanges. In the short rallies, four shots or less, Felix 134 to 101. That is a plus 33 advantage for FAA. So you might say, you look at that and you think about the serve, you think about the return, what went down in those scenarios. Frankly, I don't think that those things, the serve and the return, were the difference makers in the 0-4 shot rallies. I don't think that's the reason why you had that disparity and that massive advantage for Felix. I'm going to pull up the stats right now so that I can give you a little bit of reasoning here. So aces were 16 to 15 FAA. He hit one more ace, which isn't a perfect stat when you're trying to measure serve potency, but it's certainly the best stat we have when it comes to measuring serve potency, and usually it is directionally correct. It would suggest to you that Team's first serve and Felix's first serve were in the vicinity of just as damaging, you know, as each other. You look at first serve in percentage. Felix was at 58%, not so good. Team was at 67%, very good. So you mean to tell me that Team, you mean to tell me that Felix served way better than Team? I don't buy it. I don't buy it at all. The difference was the forehand. That's it. It's the third shot. It's the plus one forehand. Notice for the Australian Open matches now, the stat summary on the broadcast actually has a new stat. The stat is hunting third shot forehand. And usually for the male players, you see that number around 80%. There's fluctuations, right? If you're dealing with like a Zverev or a Medvedev, number's going to be lower. If you're dealing with the Felix, who's going to run around whenever he possibly can, he's going to run around, that number might be even higher, like around 90%. But that to me was the difference between Felix and Team in this match. FAA had a forehand that certainly had its wobbles or its blips, but for large stretches of the match was extremely effective. Finding that ideal balance of safety and damage, which means, you know, picking targets well, picking his spins and his heights and his paces well, which is kind of what it comes down to for Felix. And I just think, you know, his forehand was controlling the point behind his serve on a consistent basis. Team's forehand, it's just not enough right now. It's just not enough. I know we've talked about this a lot, but I think especially in the first set and the second set, it was so clear that this was the part of Dominic's game that was mostly holding him back. The forehand is just, it's 20% less violent than it used to be. Again, you know, go back and watch the 2019 team footage. Go watch the 2020 team footage. Whatever you think his forehand is today, you know, whatever you think you're seeing in matches, because it's not like, it's not as if Team never hits a forehand winner. It's not as if it's like super blatantly slow and it's going to jump out, but compare it to back then. And that's where you're really going to see the difference. Not only is it like 20% less violent than it used to be, it's also just not very consistent. And I think the reason it's not very consistent is nowadays he needs to flatten the forehand out in order to get the ball through his opponents. Like, he needs to lower the net clearance and sometimes, you know, risk not dipping the ball down and hitting long. He needs to risk those things because he's hitting flat in order to do damage. Team never used to have to hit flat. He could hit 85 mile per hour forehands with tons of RPM. He's not doing that anymore. That's the difference. Now, that said, it was a very close match. It did go five sets. The first factor to that was Felix let the nerves get the better of him at times. He should have won the match in straights. He had a lead in the third set tiebreak. He made a lot of bad mistakes to blow that lead in the third set tiebreak. Battling demons, you know, not a lot of confidence. I also think Felix could have served better, could have served a lot better. 9.6% ace rate for FAA, in my opinion. That should be higher. If Felix wants to get back to the top 10, I think that needs to be higher long-term. 58% in, as I mentioned, that's pretty low, especially for a five-set match. Team also did some things well. He had a lot of really big moments on his first serve, you know, getting free points in big spots. I also thought that he defended very well. He appeared to be in very good shape, willing to do a lot of running. He did not gas out over the course of the five sets. He certainly did a lot of good grinding when he had to. And I don't, you know, you guys know me. When I say grinding, I truly do mean that as a compliment. I appreciate the value of good defense, of wearing down your opponent in long rallies. I very much appreciate the value of that, especially against Felix, who doesn't excel in that area of the game. Also, the backhand down the line. Most of his terrific offensive moments were backhands down the line. Felix was very hesitant to come forward. That helped team defend and bother Felix with his defense, extend rallies more. And also, Felix was setting the rallies in the ad court whenever he got the chance, which I think is a mistake. What I mean by that is when Felix had a forehand in the middle of the court, especially one that he couldn't really attack, he was always hitting into the ad court and making team hit a backhand. So one of the reasons I thought Felix had a disadvantage in rallies, team got the better of rallies, is because Felix was setting backhand to backhand exchanges in moments where he should have gone to team's forehand, because if you go to team's forehand, well, now Felix gets his own forehand. So, you know, I feel like the best way to play team right now is to make him run to his right and hit forehands, not play into the ad side, make him hit backhands. I think his backhand is more solid at this time than his forehand. So, team has now lost his last 4-5 setters. Three of those are post-wrist surgery. The first one was the Pablo Andujar loss, first round of Roland Garros, which was right before the wrist injury that came on the grass a week or two later. So if it feels like this keeps happening to team, if it feels like he loses every close match at majors, you're right. That is what's happening here. So I think there's a lot of mental scarring without a doubt. When it comes to the specifics of the fifth set, where might you have seen that? I mean, I would say it wasn't at the end of the set. It was at one all in the fifth where he just had this massive letdown. I mean, he double faulted twice to start the game at one all in the fifth. What is that? Like, Dominic Thiem has one of my favorite second serves. This might sound like hyperbole. Dominic Thiem in his prime has one of my favorite second serves ever. Like, I adore his kick serve. I think it's like one of the best. Two double faults in a row to start the game. I mean, I have to wonder and question if there's a focus thing at play there, because that's not typical. And then, by the way, on the break point there where Felix finished a volley, I didn't like Thiem's movement where, you know, he really should have known that a drop volley was coming because he was so deep in the court when Felix hit the backhand volley, and Thiem split step from like 4 feet behind the baseline. You don't split step there. You just run in. You know the volley's coming short, so just run in. And he should have gotten to that and made a better pass. Instead, he was really having to kind of reach for the ball. Body language and negativity is also something that is probably a bigger part of Thiem's game than it used to be. So those are all my thoughts on Thiem versus Felix in that first round match. Next one is from House of Leaves. Hi, Gil. What are your thoughts on Zverev being elected to the ATP Player Advisory Council? Considering the allegations and upcoming court case, it's pretty sickening and puzzling to me. First of all, for those who don't know, you are elected to such position by your fellow players. In Zverev's case, as a top 50 player, he would have been elected as their representative by his fellow top 50 players. So look, the message that it sends is very, very clear. They're not concerned. They're not concerned about the pending allegations, the pending court case that Alexander Zverev is going to be involved in. Date was set yesterday. This is breaking news. End of May. End of May is when the appeals process will play out in court, which is right around Roland Garros time, but Zverev is not required to appear in person. So we just learned that yesterday. For the players to say, you know, of all the options, Alexander Zverev is the person who should represent us in a leadership position. It says that they do not care about this, and that they are unconcerned by it. And what can I say? I don't agree with that. I think the situation we're in, without presuming Zverev's guilt, without presuming his innocence either, is just, it's frankly a situation that is serious. A judge has looked over the evidence in this case. And by the way, it's not a civil case. It is a state level, you know, criminal prosecution. A judge has looked at the evidence and issued a penalty, right? A penalty order. Zverev has appealed that penalty. So if that appeal is successful, okay. If it's not successful, okay. But right now, where are we? Right now, we're in a situation where Zverev is in some legal trouble, okay? And I think being in some legal trouble of this nature, which I take seriously, is enough of a concern to maybe refrain from electing him as a leader and a representative. There's also a press conference storyline that has emerged over the course of the last couple days. Let's face it, it's been a big week for Zverev news. A couple things have happened. One, he was elected to the ATP Player Advisory Council. Two, Netflix's Breakpoint Season 2 came out and portrayed Zverev as a bona fide protagonist, an absolute hero with absolutely no counterweight to that narrative. Zero. Including things that have nothing to do with domestic violence stuff, right? For example, showing a montage of every time Medvedev has misbehaved in his career, as if that's Daniil's thing. Didn't show what Zverev did in Acapulco, which was worse than anything, in my opinion, that Medvedev has ever done.
What kind of fun is waiting for you at Kings Island? The holy cow, we're way too high and here comes the drop kind of fun. The make a splash all summer kind of fun. The I can't believe I ate that whole funnel cake. Let's get another kind of fun. But most importantly, at Kings Island, you'll find for the fun of it kind of fun.
Don't wait to start your fun this season. Kings Island is now open weekends.
Saving money on everything for your projects. Now at Menards. We have it all for garden and landscaping essentials. Visit our outdoor garden center today and update your backyard space. Grid accents lattice panels have a timeless design with an innovative design that's simple to install and requires almost no maintenance. Save big on lattice panel options at Menards. View our entire selection of garden center products today on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
So that happened, and now third piece of breaking news, as I just said, the date for his trial was set. So those three things all happened in 1 week. But I believe a journalist for The Age, a newspaper in Australia, decided to do a story on, I don't know if the primary point of the story was based on the breaking news that a date for his trial is set, or if it was based on the news that he was elected to the Player Council. But what I read from The Age was an article that talked about both of those things and discussed the response that the players have had to those things. And by the way, I'm not 100% sure that the journalist who was asking players about this situation in the press conferences was with The Age. I'm not 100% sure. I don't know who it was. But three players were asked. Grigor Dimitrov, Casper Ruud, Stefanos Tsitsipas. All three of them were asked about it. They were asked specifically about Zverev's place on the player council. And all of them gave a version of, I don't know about this. I don't have enough information about this. No comment. It's the gist of what all of them said. In a lot of ways, I'm very sympathetic to that. They probably weren't expecting the question. That's the area where I'm sympathetic to it. It's not an easy question to answer. They are not politicians or, you know, people who are expected to be very, I guess, like nimble when it comes to answering difficult questions. So in that sense, I get how they would be caught off guard and not prepared for the question, right? That said, the fact that a lot of them acted like they have never heard of any domestic violence issue with Zverev, the kind of like, I don't know anything, right? Like Zverev said, Dimitrov basically said, like, I don't consume any media, as if he doesn't know. Of course he knows. This has been a major thing for like, what, 2-3 years? Of course he knows. So I thought the flat, you know, no comment responses did come across as a little bit crass and indifferent, but I also respect that they probably weren't prepared for the question. So I went on Twitter, and I want to talk about this, if not for my own therapy and mental health, but also because I think it, you know, it did spark an interesting conversation. I want to talk about my tweet. So after seeing Dimitrov and Tsitsipas and Casper Ruud all give this response, and I saw that they started to face a little bit of criticism for what they said, I thought to myself, okay, what would be a good answer in a press conference? How should you answer this? So I tried to give a little human advice, PR advice. I tried to be a voice of reason, and say, okay, well, you don't have to comment on Zverev. In fact, you shouldn't comment on Zverev. Completely understand. You should not comment on the specific details of Alexander Zverev's case. He is a colleague. You have to see him every day. And I totally get that it's not really your business or your place to comment on that. If you want to, okay. But if you don't want to, I 100% get that. Look, let's face it. If someone I worked with, like let's say, God forbid, someone I worked with was charged with something like this, and you guys asked me in the mailbag to comment on it, I would not comment on it. Probably not. It would not be my place to comment on it. So I'm in lockstep with the players for that, when it comes to that. I think what I said on Twitter is that it would also be a nice thing that would come across as probably just a better answer would be to just generally condemn domestic violence, just in general condemn it. And there were a lot of really passionate responses to that. So essentially, if I were an agent and I could prepare my player knowing that they may be asked about this, the response that I would recommend would be just say, I can't comment on the specifics of Alexander Zverev. I won't comment on the specifics of that, but there can be no tolerance for domestic violence, no place for it in the sport, something like that. Whatever you want to say that just shows that you do care about the issue, that you do feel like it's important. Just show that a little bit. I think it's appreciated. That's all. I just think it's appreciated. I'm not calling Casper or Stefanos or Grigor. I'm not calling them bad people. I'm not saying they don't care about domestic violence. I'm just saying their answers could have just included something that made that clear. That would be my recommendation. That's all I was saying. And I was trying to, in some ways, be the adult in the room that acknowledged that, look, let's be realistic here. They're not going to comment on Zverev directly. It's not their place, but also that they could have made better comments. I was trying to take that middle ground. The people on X were not having that middle ground. Not the people in the replies. A lot of people were mad. In some ways, I was surprised by that. I was caught off guard by that because I thought I was, again, being moderate here and going in the middle. Which I'm not doing it to be in the middle. I'm doing that because I think it's the correct stance. But in some ways, at the same time, it's not surprising because this is something that elicits a lot of passion. So let me just talk about this. Because I did not, I would have spent all night if I was responding to everybody's replies or continuing to tweet on this thread. Frankly, I regret posting this. I regret it because it took up so much of my mental energy last night, distracted me immensely while I was trying to watch the tennis. I love coming on here and talking about my opinions. I love that. I hate doing that on X. And over the course of the last year, I've tried not to do it for a multitude of reasons. I think a lot of people don't read. I think a lot of people, the character limit limits the amount of nuance that it's possible to go into. And also a lot of people who don't know you are going to see your tweet and they do not care about you. They do not come in with any level of respect or prior knowledge of your work. And they're just going to be absolutely ruthless because they don't care. So that's why I really don't like tweeting anything controversial on X anymore. Used to do it all the time. Anyway, this was a slip up. This was a relapse. I regret tweeting it. Okay, but here is my response for the blowback or to the blowback that this tweet received. Besides the people who had horrible reading comprehension and completely strawmanned it, which was about 50% of the replies, forget them. I'm not going to pay them any attention. There were some people who read the tweet, understood the tweet, and still disagreed. Them I'll respond to. So the two issues were, one, many people said, look, it's obvious. Of course they condemn domestic violence. It's assumed. My response to that's pretty simple. So what? It's still a nice thing to say. That's all. It's just appreciated. Probably appreciated by many. Just to show you care. Just to show you care enough to speak out against it. Easy thing to say. Nice thing to say. That's it. That's all. I appreciate the fact that nobody's going to come out and be like, I'm pro domestic violence. I get that. I know. It's just a nice thing to say. By the way, I don't know a lot of, thank goodness, I don't know a lot of domestic violence victims personally. None of them, I'm not close with any, which is great. But the one person who I do know reached out to me, said that they appreciated my tweet. I mean, people, DV victims, and there's far too many of them out there, they appreciate these kinds of things. So nice thing to do. That's it. Okay. The second piece of blowback is a little bit more complex than the first. People argued that it shouldn't have been asked in the first place. And I take a lot of blame for the way I wrote the tweet, for why so many of the replies came out so strongly with this stance. I completely understand why they took that stance, especially if they just saw my tweet. Because the way I wrote it, it sounded like perhaps the journalist was in the press conference just being like, hey, so what do you think of this Zverev trial? Guilty or innocent? Like, what do you think? That would be completely inappropriate, completely unnecessary, uncalled for. And if the question was of that nature, I wouldn't have had any problem at all with the no comment, because I would have understood the reaction, you know, the visceral reaction. I would understand if a player felt immediately like that person was acting in bad faith. However, that's not what the question was. It's not what the journalist was doing, as I explained before. And again, it makes sense that people don't understand this, but let me try to explain. If you are doing a story that intends to cover Zverev's inclusion on the Players Council, if that is in your article, Zverev's inclusion in the Players Council, then the players themselves, particularly in this case, any top 50 player, they are a perfect and appropriate source for your story. They voted him in. They are now being represented by him. So do not tell me that Casper Ruud, Stefanos Tsitsipas, and Grigor Dimitrov, and any other player who may be asked about this in the future, do not tell me that they have nothing to do with it, that it is none of their business. It is their business when it comes to him being on the Players Council, which is what the question was about. One of the stakeholders, one of the key stakeholders in the story you're writing is the players. So, of course, you should ask the players about this, of course. If you want a quote on this, you go to the players. They are the best source, other than Zverev, who is unavailable that day until very, very late. And of course, they asked Zverev too. Zverev was asked about it. So I know it's hard to understand. I know you feel for the players because it's a tough question for them. And it's not their fault that they're being asked about it, other than maybe perhaps their fault for voting Zverev onto the Players Council when this dark cloud is hanging over him right now. But do you understand that if you are a journalist writing about this story, that the players are your source because they are the subject at play, the ones who elected him, the ones who are now represented by him on the council? Okay, it's very simple. All right, that's all I got on this. Next one from Alpine. Hey Gil, I'm always interested in learning about court speed. So how would you compare the Australian Open court to the other outdoor hard courts we have on tour? I feel like it's a lot slower this year. Now, look, it's tough to talk about court speed without good data. I am currently working behind the scenes to bring you Monday Match Analysis viewers and listeners good data on court speed so that we can really pinpoint these things in a good manner. Now, I actually do think this is going to take some time, but this is my hope for the future. Here's what I'll say. Just eye test, looking at the rally lengths and looking at the way the ball is coming through the court and breaks of serve and ace rates, I am much more inclined to call this year's Australian Open court medium. Much more inclined to call it medium. In past years, I've been inclined to call it fast, or at least medium quick. So to me, they're slower. Courts were resurfaced before this year, so it makes sense that there's been a change. I don't think the balls are different, but the courts were resurfaced. And the resurfacing is going to have a really big effect on how fast your courts are, right? Miami Open, good example. They resurfaced last year. James Blake, the tournament director, specifically asked the manufacturer to speed up the courts. Courts were faster. Next one is from Memesy. Hi, Gil. What do you think of the rule change at Australian Open this year that allows spectators to come in between every game rather than every second game in changeovers? Some players have mentioned it being disruptive and slowing up the match. Overreaction to a small change or a genuine issue? I think there's a simple fix for this, because I understand what the problem with the traditional rule is, where part of your experience at a tennis match, sorry, at a tennis event, is waiting on lines for crazy amounts of time. And like, you're trying to build a good product here. You're trying to be fan friendly. That ain't it, obviously. So I get that part of it. I also get the part of it where players don't want the flow of the match to be disrupted. Players don't want movement in their sight lines, which is, by the way, for what it's worth, far more disruptive, in my opinion, than extraneous noise that's happening. I think the visual stuff is far worse. Okay, here's my solution. Can we just make sure that there is no movement behind the bass lines? Like, that is the off-limits portion of the court. And then the rest of the courts are open season to come in between every game. Isn't that logical? Can't we do that? That's my answer to this. From Solomon. Hey, you love your content as always. Seems like Shelton made light work of RBA as opposed to a potential upset. He may, after all, meet Djokovic in the fourth round. 2 days ago, Djokovic finally told us the truth about the hang up the phone celebration on L'Equipe. Did I say it right? Did I say it right this time? What's your thought on the new info? And what do you think the atmosphere will be like before their fourth round match? Look, let's not get ahead of ourselves. I think the atmosphere will be kind of electric, like it kind of always is for a fourth round match. Djokovic on Laver, Ben Shelton, the player, brings a lot of energy. But what's the question here? Oh, what's your thought on the new info? Come on, guys. Anybody who watched Novak's press conference knows that he was being sarcastic when he said that he liked the celebration. Of course it was tongue-in-cheek. Of course it was sarcasm. Duh. There's no news here. I mean, yeah, he was willing to say it, that he felt disrespected by Shelton. Look at the handshake. Look at the handshake. Of course, Djokovic, that was the tell. Like, at first I saw Djokovic do the celebration, and then I was like, ooh, I don't think he's very happy. Then I saw the handshake, and it's like, oh, yeah. He's pissed. He was not happy with Shelton at all. So we didn't learn anything here.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And it's your last chance to get more fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this limited-time bundle ends June 30th. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance, while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
I didn't really talk about the handshake thing last year at the U.S. Open at all. I just let the fans go about it. You know, I thought it was a fun story for everybody to kind of weigh into. It kind of broke through outside of the tennis bubble, and you had mainstream sports fans in the United States kind of debating kind of whose side they were on, Djokovic or Shelton. I think these things are good for the game. So, you know, me, in my position, I decided to kind of just sit on the sidelines and let people argue it out. But I will say this as kind of an overarching take. I think both guys are just trying to get a competitive edge. And I think that's really what it comes down to. Novak Djokovic is pretty easy to offend on the court. Like, we've seen him, you know, we've seen him get into that mode against Cam Norrie, for example, when like Norrie hits a ball at him. I don't think he really thinks in his heart of hearts, like if you asked him, do you think Cam was trying to hit you? I think now after the fact, he'd be like, nah, probably not. You know, I don't think so. But Novak as a competitor is going to use whatever fuel is offered to him to try to compete better. And this is something that a lot of Novak's idols have done. Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant. Wasn't it a big meme for the Michael Jordan documentary, The Last Dance, that MJ just took everything personally? It didn't take much. It didn't take much for MJ to basically grab on to something his opponent does that he perceives as disrespect and then uses that as motivation to try to beat their ass. That's what I think Novak did against Shelton. That's my read on it. Ben, on the other hand, all of the things he does, it's not in the interest of being unsportsmanlike or disrespectful. It's in the interest of competing as best he can. So all that bravado, all that confidence, all the things that he said to his box in that match, to his box, not to Novak, was to make him confident. Like, confidence is important in tennis. Shelton is as confident as they come, and these are his tactics to be confident. That positive self-talk is part of Ben Shelton's way of competing. All right, next is from Nole Fan. Hey, Gil, been watching your content for years. Thanks for all the hours of preparation and hard work you put into each video. Appreciate that. So here's something I never thought I'd say, LOL. I listened to McEnroe Kyrgios commentating on the Tsitsipas match of all matches and loved it. How about you? Thoughts on this pairing? I listened to it too. Yeah. So Nick Kyrgios was the analyst and John McEnroe was the lead or the play-by-play on Tsitsipas' match against Zizou Berks in the first round. Here's my opinion on it. I think both of them bring some great value as commentators. McEnroe is an entertainer in the truest sense. You can, as a tennis fan, be bothered by some things or call into question some things about McEnroe's commentary style. All of those things are valid. But at the end of the day, if I were a television executive and it was my job to hire someone who is going to entertain an ESPN audience on tennis, John McEnroe would probably be someone who I would hire. He is a personality. He is a true entertainer, a natural at that. So Mac is great in that sense. Kyrgios is a really sharp tennis mind, who can bring a lot of recent experiences on tour into focus, has played against all of these guys who he's commentating on, which is a bonus. That goes away eventually for these former players who become announcers. He can bring a lot of insight, Nick Kyrgios. So I think both of them bring a lot of great value as commentators. Together, without anyone else, I was frustrated by certain gaps in information in this broadcast. And look, I talked about it in my last video. Like, Tsitsipas had this back thing and started serving with a pinpoint serve technique. And Kyrgios noticed it right away. He noticed it in warmups. Because obvious, right? Very, very jarring to see that for Tsitsipas. But McEnroe and Nick the whole time were just like, wow, I can't believe he's doing that. I don't know. I don't know why he did it. Like, they had no clue. They had no clue. The back injury was never mentioned on the broadcast. And that's because they don't do any preparation. And I'm not being derogatory. I don't think so. I think John McEnroe would tell you very comfortably that he doesn't do preparation. I think he'd admit that. I think Nick Kyrgios would also admit that he doesn't do preparation. So for them, they get away with it in a lot of ways, and they still bring a lot to the table as broadcasters without doing preparation. I wish there was someone there who did do preparation so that that information could have found its way into the broadcast. I was frustrated by that. But other than that, there was a lot of aspects that I enjoyed about it as well. Next one is from member Ryan. Thank you so much for being a member. It's the best way to support the channel. You hit the join button, contribute $2 a month. Again, goes a long way in helping out the channel in the short term and the long term. All right, Ryan says, hi, Gil. Besides Bublik, who hasn't played yet, all of your upset alerts have miraculously made it to round two. Do you think any of them will keep it going in the next round? Okay, well, that requires a bit of a rundown. By the way, Bublik losing to Summit Nagal, which is an amazing story. Congratulations to Summit. Congratulations to all Indian tennis fans around the world. First Indian to beat a seeded player at a slam since 1989. There you go. So congratulations to him. And I think he's 35 years old too. It's a great story. Okay. So my upset alerts. Let's check in on all of them. Bublik is out. So that was the correct call. In Djokovic's quarter, it was Shelton. Oh yeah, who beat RBA. So I watched a lot of that match. I don't think Shelton played that great, honestly. For the first two sets, he wasn't getting enough out of his serve. It was too easy for RBA to draw errors out of his backhand. I don't think Shelton was absorbing quality very well on his backhand side. But RBA was really bad. I mean, RBA, based on that performance, I'm concerned about his 2024. Because he did not have, and I knew that that might be the case because, again, he didn't come in with form. He took a couple of not so good losses coming into the Australian Open. But this is generally when Bautista Agut plays his very best tennis. And I thought he was very unclutch. I don't think he was taking enough opportunities when he had short balls on his forehand side to do meaningful damage with consistency. I don't think his shot tolerance is where it used to be or even close anymore. So that was kind of my read on the round one. Not to take anything away from Shelton. Ben did play well in the third set. I'll give him that. So now we go to the draw. Shelton next round has Christopher O'Connell. O'Connell's coming off of a five-setter against Garin. I mean, let's see how O'Connell returns. You know, I don't know how well he's going to return Shelton's serve, but I still have that as like a semi-upset alert. Semi. Almost there. Because O'Connell has a really good, he's a really good peak level. I do think it might be kind of tough for Shelton to find a lot of breaks to serve. I do think we'll see tie breaks in that match. So margins might be slim. Shelton's got better nerve management than Chris O'Connell from everything that I've seen, but okay. Let's go to the next one. Upset alert, Sebastian Baez. Didn't he get a retirement? Yeah, JJ Wolf retired. JJ Wolf got hurt. I mean, he won the first set 6-3. He got hurt at the end of the first set. Okay. Nice second round opponent for Baez, Daniel Galan. But I would say Baez got pretty fortunate there. Then the other upset alert, Hugo Humbert. This was a good win. And I actually didn't watch much of it, but four set win over David Goffin. Now he plays Zhang Zhizhen in the second round. The good thing for Humbert is it seems like he played a really good level against Goffin. The bad news is that his second round is a lot tougher than his first round. Zhang Zhizhen is certainly a dark horse candidate. So that's going to be a tougher one for Humbert compared to even Goffin, in my opinion. Let's go now to Hardy Har. Hi, Gil. Do you think Borna Coric will ever debut in the top 10 before the end of his career? I feel like when the original next gen emerged, Borna was talked about in the Zverev Tsitsipas Medvedev group in terms of potential. And yet, while he's had some great achievements, he's never been able to sustain it for a top 10 appearance. Meanwhile, players who weren't looking quite, who weren't on that level, I'll just say, like Hurkacz, Tiafoe, Dimonor, have reached the top 10. I know he's had injury struggles, but so have Zverev and Tsitsipas, yet they still have managed to maintain or quickly return to their former levels. Meanwhile, after Borna's renaissance in Cincinnati 2022, he's been hot and cold in big tournaments. So then the question here is, well, I'll just read the whole thing. I thought he had a big chance drawing Tiafoe at the Australian Open to make a statement for the season, but obviously that didn't come to pass. And he's now reaching middle age for a tennis player. Do you think he peaked already, or does he have a top 10 season ahead of him one day? I'm going to keep this answer pretty simple. Yeah, the injuries have been a factor, but I think Borna Coric is really good proof, really good evidence when it comes to the importance of having a great forehand on the modern ATP tour. Because Borna's pretty good in every other category, right? His movement's good. His mental strength is good. I love him mentally. I think he's great mentally. His backhand is world class. His serve's pretty good. I mean, okay, that's almost everything. That forehand, it holds him back in a big way, and it just goes to show you that that's probably the worst weakness you can have, especially, I mean, there are some players who deal with that forehand weakness. They are usually elite, extra, extra special players in multiple other areas. Chorich isn't quite that, right? And look, like the issues are deep rooted. It's not an elastic forehand. It's not like a whip. It's very stilted and robotic and stiff. That's what that forehand is technically. He's never found a way to, you know, just have good tempo on his forehand, or even a way to like move his arm through the air, you know, quickly on his forehand. And it kind of destroys his ability to be a top player. That's it. Do I see that ever changing? Not really, if I'm being completely honest. Hopefully it proves me wrong. Couple more here. Next one is from another member, Enigma Paradox. What do you think of Yuri Lehechka's rise? He's 22 years old, up to number 23 in the rankings. Won his first ATP title by beating a strong Jack Draper in the Adelaide final. He's a clean ball striker and a physically fit guy. What is his ceiling? Top 10 player like Burdich, future slam winner. I don't know about future slam winner at this time. Prospects to be a top 10 player at some point are, in my opinion, pretty good. He guaranteed will be, if he is not already, one of the biggest hitters on tour off the ground, bar none. Clearly. He is a lot like Tomas Berdych. I don't see a lot of creativity in his game. I don't see a lot of defense in his game. I see some inconsistency. I don't see an elite serve, but I see a forehand and a backhand that are absolutely punishing off the ground. So he's in good shape. He's got a great foundation. He's got a good team around him. Let's see how he develops. I do kind of worry a little bit about the backhand being a very, very hot and cold wing, where sometimes it's going to be spectacular, sometimes it's going to lose him matches. On the forehand, I think it has the ability to be consistent, but it comes more down to decision-making. The backhand, I see technical stuff that's probably going to make it inconsistent. That's kind of my assessment, but I think he probably will be a future top tenner. Slam winner, I'm not ready to go that far. Okay, here is from Mr. Cora. Let's end on this question because it is a great one. Hey, Gil, in my opinion, mental strength is one of the best success predictors in tennis. Can you make a top five of the most mentally resilient young players under 25 years old on tour? So in some ways, this is really hard to answer because you're asking me to rank mental strength. And as we've discussed in the past, mental strength is a very nuanced term. There are a lot of different categories and aspects to mental strength. And I hate how often it's used just like as a blanket statement, right? I hate that. But in this case, you actually did use a very specific word. You said resilience. Now we're talking. If you ask me top five mental strength, I struggle with that. If you ask me resilience, I can do that. I also want to use stats to help me, though. You inspired me with this comment to look up which players are the best at winning matches after losing the first set. Isn't that a pretty good sign of resilience? If you can lose the first set and still win the match, that means you're good at coming from behind. And if you're good at coming from if you're good at coming back from behind, you are probably resilient. So I went on Tennis Abstract and I looked at among top 50 players, who are the best at winning after losing the set one? Alcaraz, he's got the best win percentage in the top 50. 9-7 record. I think Alcaraz is extremely resilient. There are other flaws in his mental game, but effort and resilience, that's not one of them. So this makes sense to me. Alcaraz, also really good record. 7-8. 7-8 last year after losing first sets. That's really good. Here's one that doesn't surprise me at all. Matteo Arnaldi. I've talked a lot about already how much I love his attitude. He fights. He fights really hard. His record after losing the first set, 7-9. That's even more impressive for a player who overall last year at tour level had a record of 20-15. So you can see he's not someone like Alcaraz or Sinner who's winning a crazy percentage of matches and is better, you know, by a lot than most of his opponents. Arnaldi, of all of these guys, is the most impressive from a resilience standpoint because in a lot of these cases, he is not that much worse after losing the first set than he is after winning the first set, right? You see what I'm saying? There's not that big a disparity for Arnaldi after losing the first set versus a totality of all his matches, which is really impressive. Okay, Fritz. Fritz was decent, 7-13. Drop off from the other guys, but I think that's something Taylor probably doesn't get enough credit for, is how hard he fights. He's a pretty stubborn competitor. Pretty good. Demonor is someone who comes to mind when you think about resilience. The stats weren't awesome last year. He was 8-24, but I still think he deserves to be number 5 on my list because we know that he works hard. We know he fights hard, and 8-24 is not terrible. Just wasn't great. Here is who was bad. Here are the players who were bad last year after losing the first set. Davidovich Fokina was 2-21 in matches after dropping the opener. Doesn't really surprise me. He's overly emotional. Moody. Sometimes he sulks when things aren't going his way. Doesn't really surprise me. Hugo Humbert, 3-20. Again, doesn't surprise me that much. Arthur Fils, 3-15. Did surprise me a little bit. Runa, 6-19. I don't know. There could be other things at play. Maybe that speaks to the stamina issues he was having last year. Certainly, Holger should be better than 6-19 after losing the first set. If you look at, you know, especially the people who we're comparing him to. Alcaraz, 9-7. Sinner, 7-8. Runa should be better than 6-19. But in terms of resilience, he's someone who wants it really bad, works very hard, no doubt about it. You know, you can't question his desire, but you can question his ability to stay calm when things are going the wrong way. You can question his ability to keep a quiet mind, to stay relaxed and to search for solutions without letting his emotions get the better of him. So that is my answer. Again, my top 5 most mentally resilient young players on tour, not in any like strict order, but it's Alcaraz, Sinner, Arnaldi, Fritz, and Demonor. Fritz is 25, right? Taylor Fritz age. He's 26. All right. You got to give me a pass because there's no going back now, and I'm not going to go find someone who is 25 or under to try to fix this. All right. That'll do it. Hope you enjoyed. Don't forget to subscribe. I'll see you next time.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And it's your last chance to get more fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this limited-time bundle ends June 30th. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity, set up chores, and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger. For the ones who get it done.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.